I'm Elle Minor, curatorial assistant at the Hirshhorn Museum, and I'm here with Robert Barry, an artist whose works we just acquired for the collection from the collection of European collector Dr. Giuseppe Ponza. We have four works of Robert Barry's that will be on view as part of the new exhibition, the Ponza Collection. And the artist has been here for 2 days supervising the installation of the works. I wanted to start with the earliest piece, which is steel disc suspended 1/8 inch above the floor from 1967, which consists of a 2-inch steel disc hung from the ceiling on clear monofilament wire. This is one of the last works you did that was object-oriented before moving greatly towards text. Can you talk a little bit about this piece and sort of if it was transitional and how it fits in with your larger body of work?
All my work is transitional. It deals with the same themes as the paintings and really what came after. That is to say, the space and the situation that the object is in, and activate that space in some sort of personal, aesthetic way. And the idea of the weight, the steel disc is 2 inches in diameter, but it's about 1/2 inch thick, so it's got some substance to it. It's acts as a weight. You have the monofilament, which is very transparent, and if you step back a little bit, it's almost invisible. And I guess I was playing with the space, the very, very small space between the bottom of the disc and the floor itself, which would be about 1/8 of an inch, and then that long space above, which goes to the ceiling, the interplay of the material, the reflection of the steel. It's a kind of polished steel, so it kind of reflects a little bit the room and yourself. So in many levels, it kind of, although the piece itself is one idea, but it changes every time it's shown in a different location. And this is some idea that I've been working with in my painting, certainly, from some years before that, where the small panels, small squares of paint, colored paint, monochrome, would be placed on the wall in some kind of geometric or symmetrical way, but it would activate the wall that it was on. It was, toward the end, most of the paintings were actually empty wall space, and it would just sort of delineate some of the space on the wall. And it was, once again, meant to confront the viewer in some sort of a phenomenal way, so that if the viewer, he or she, chose to involve themselves, engage themselves in what was going on in front of them, then hopefully they would get some kind of interesting experience of themselves dealing with what I was presenting to them. And this piece kind of grows out of that idea. The material had, at that point, been reduced to monofilament and not using color, and really trying to use the situation and the place in which the piece was presented as really part of the whole aesthetic idea. Not part of the piece, but part of the environment in which the piece was activating the space and engaging the viewer in some way. And just after that, I was just using monofilament as a way of stretching it from wall to ceiling, a different kind of different ways of sort of measuring out the room in which it was existing, or even outside. I did some outside pieces using nylon monofilament. It's there. It's certainly a material. But it borders invisibility, especially if it's at some distance from the viewer. And I kind of like that idea of sort of pushing the visibility of art. And then, of course, after that, I sort of got into these invisible materials, or materials that were not not perceivable by the eyes anyway.
I know you did, for instance, the Inert Gas series, a group of works where you would release different gases or chemicals into an environment.
Gas, inert gas. I returned them to the atmosphere because they came from the atmosphere, so it was a kind of a cyclical idea.
Now, those were documented in photographs, and sometimes possibly with a label on the wall, correct?
Well, they would be. They were framed with a typed text explaining the title and the place where and how much of it was released.
Yeah. How important was the text in that particular instance?
Well, it's very important. It was, otherwise you wouldn't know what the photographs were about. We call it documentation. And I like the idea that each piece was released in a different location, at a different time of day, and different amounts, and there were, I think there are 5 inert gases. This was an idea that really studied about the inert gases back when I was in a high school science class, and they just seemed to me to be kind of interesting. They were called the noble gases, that's the name for them. The names in Greek are kind of nice, and their gas, which is used by us, I mean, it's used to light. If you put current through it, you get different kinds of light. Neon, of course, is the one most, but xenon and argon, you've heard of argon lamps, and they produce different kinds of light. And they just had qualities which were just attracted me to them. They come from the atmosphere. You have to take them out of the atmosphere. And we didn't, at that point, we had only known about them for about 100 years. They were only discovered about 100 years earlier. People weren't even aware that these existed in the atmosphere. But it's also a material that we breathe in and breathe out. I mean, we're physically engaged with it, so to speak. So it was just a kind of an attractive thing that I just stayed in the back of my mind. Some writer wrote about them at one point, I remember. They just had this appeal to me, and they're inert, which means they don't change chemically. They remain the same all the time. They don't intermix with any other molecules. It's taken out of the atmosphere and then put into a measured container that you can buy, scientific warehouse. And the sort of the subtitle of the show was From Measured Volume to Indefinite Expansion. It was called the Inert Gas Series, From Measured Volume to Indefinite Expansion. And the idea of releasing this gas back into the atmosphere and have it endlessly expand in the universe and change, in the atmosphere and change. The idea of cycles, cyclical, was something that I was working on then. Starting at one point, going around, coming back to the same point, but with a different experience. These are all very basic ideas that I think have to do with life, the way we live, and that people can relate to, makes a real connection between art and life. This is what my art was reflecting at that time, and to a large extent still does.
Now, the 3 other works that are on view all employ text, and I'm sure viewers are going to want to know how you select the words you choose to use.
It's all intuitive, just intuitive. Reading, see something, underline it in red, and go back and write it down. Or I hear someone on the radio use a word. There is no method. It's just what strikes me that I think I can use. I like words that sort of reflect a certain state of being. I don't use words like table or chair or anything like no specific nouns. Words that I think are suggestive of something, but nothing really definite. I kind of like the concreteness of the image, the word image, which I think is interesting because they also have a look. They design a certain color, height, typeface, go to a lot of trouble. to find the right font, and also sometimes we have to change the look in the computer a little bit. But also they have this kind of ambiguous nature. They don't really have any meaning by themselves. They're just floating in space or put into a spatial situation, into an artistic situation. They have this ambiguous presence. And art is basically ambiguous anyway. I mean, it's not something really specific. Everybody comes to it with a different point of view. And so I kind of like that contrast, that quality, that the fact that these words have a history. If someone chooses to become involved and look at it, they react to it in their own personal way with their own history, and they make of it what they want. And the role of the spectator is important in my work. It's aimed at someone becoming engaged in it, and language is a very good way to draw someone into it, because words come from us. You can't find them in the world outside. So it's something quite personal, and even if it's just for a second or so, that to become engaged with the word is a way of sort of drawing the spectator in, and that's what I want to do. Make some connection. I mean, that's the reason for making art, right? So you connect with somebody else, even though you may not know that person. And it creates a kind of a nice energy between the artwork and the spectator. That space between the spectator and the artwork is sort of important. It's another way of dealing with the aesthetic space. Sort of a step beyond the old paintings and the sculpture.
Now we have two wall drawings and one slide piece. The slide piece is called...
I call them wall pieces. Solowit makes wall drawings.
Gotcha. The slide piece is called It Has Variety, It Can Change, which is a slide projector with 59 text slides and one blank.
Yeah.
As compared to the works that are on the wall, what role does sort of the cadence or the timing play in that?
Well, timing is important, isn't it? I mean, it's broken down. It's an element that I like in my work. I always wanted to work with time, and it was sort of evasive. It was certainly in my work, but this really confronts the idea of time. I mean, the projector is kind of like a clock ticking when you hear it clicking away. And I also like the idea of an art made out of light and dark. And the words just kind of appear kind of spooky there, not really, they're only there for a few seconds and then they're gone and something else comes to take its place. And I like that way of presenting. I mean, it deals with time directly and the concepts. It's about it. It is, you know, it can be, whatever. And you say, well, what is it that we're talking about here? You know, I mean, well, nothing really. I mean, it's whatever you want it to be, essentially. And although it's defined with all these words, you're never really quite sure what I'm talking about. And as one critic said, that I'm describing art. And you could think of it in that way. You know, the it is really art itself. I didn't think about that when I was doing it. I was just trying to create some kind of mental object, some sort of sort of ambiguous, ephemeral kind of thing that might be something very personal within the mind of the person who's looking at it.
One question that comes up with the slide projector piece that's been discussed here at the museum is the role of the projector itself. We talked about timing, you've mentioned the sound. From a conservation standpoint, do you hope that museums in the future will use the original type of projector, which is what we're doing, or what happens if it's moved digital?
This is, unless you're making paintings or sculpture in bronze or stone, if you're working with technology, the technology is always changing, and this is just something that one has to consider. That eventually Kodak is going to stop making those bulbs. I think they've already stopped making the projectors themselves. In some distant future time, they're all going to break down, and there will be no more. kind of like the universe. Eventually, there won't be any more projectors, and I have transferred a couple to DVD discs, and it kind of works. You know, it sort of works pretty well. You kind of get the same idea. But I think if we worry about the preciousness of the object too much, you kind of miss the idea. But this is a work which is really about what the words mean and about the timing. And certainly the look is kind of interesting because it looks like a certain kind of work that I did at that time in my life. But I think if those basic things can be preserved in a more advanced technology, that is to say that if the new technology can incorporate everything that the old technology has, but do it a little nicer, a little smoother, keep it going, I don't see a problem. And in a way, it kind of keeps the work going forever. You know, it's kind of like a Solowit drawing. I mean, you put them up there, and then eventually the wall's going to be painted over, and, you know, it will exist. But Saul gave us all the instructions on how to do it, and you can always find a couple of young people willing to sit down for a few weeks and do it. So in that way, they will always be there, you know. And the idea of doing that is something that the idea of making infinite works is something which I like. And the radioactive pieces where you have a half-life, where you always have and have and have and have and have, so that theoretically the energy is always there, it's just been reduced. Either the half-life is a hundredth of a second in some, or it can be 100,000 years in another, so that this difference in time is very important, but it does, in a sense, reflect infinity. Or the radio wave pieces going out into space. I mean, you know, they just extend into the universe infinitely.
This show is really based, you know, around a single collector. And at the time that Dr. Pons was, you know, acquiring works by you and the other artists in the show, it was a pretty radical notion to be collecting sort of non-object-based works. What kind of particular directions, you know, do you leave behind? Or what does someone like, whether it be Count Panza or another collector, what do they get when they purchase a Robert Barry work?
What do they get physically? Mm-hmm. Well, Panza had us all sign contracts. We had to sit down and sign to indicate that he owned this thing and there would be a description of the work. He got that, but he, you know, he essentially collected objects or descriptions of objects or descriptions of something that could be done repeatedly ad infinitum. That's what he got. I mean, when he bought something, he got something pretty substantial. He was an industrialist and a businessman, so he wasn't going to just buy something that he couldn't have on a piece of a signed statement on a. He couldn't have your signature on a piece of paper.
There's definitely been, I think, a lot of attention paid over time to your work in Europe. And Dr. Panza is a European collector. What is your feeling on sort of the difference between how more conceptual work has been looked at from a European audience as opposed to an American?
I think it was
audience?
Their history. Their involvement with art is simply just much stronger than ours. And they went through, they were much more appreciative of some of the more conceptual things like Dada, for instance, and you know, things like that. It's just that the culture is more engaged in their art history and in their art culture than I think we were here in the States. I think that began to change as people traveled more. Panza really came to our work, I think, mostly. I think one would have to credit a dealer like Gian Enzo Speroni. And then later, Leo Castelli. But I think Leo became interested in our work mainly through Ponza, because Ponza was a big collector of Leo, and then Leo came to through Speroni to Leo and told Leo, I said, look, there are these artists, Americans and Europeans, who are doing this work, which is really interesting. And then Leo looked into it and immediately started showing. And then John Weber sort of got on, and then a couple of other dealers sort of picked up on some of the artists, the smarter dealers in New York. But it really was the Europeans who sought it out, and were in New York in the late 60s, and were looking at the land art and the more conceptual guys. And it was the first really sort of universal art movement when you think about it, because there were some terrific artists in Italy, and you had Biren and some of the other guys in France, and you had some of the Germans, and they all seemed to be working, doing terrific art all around the same time. And young dealers were popping up, people who were just like Paul Mance and Conrad Fischer, who was the first to show Saul and Lawrence and, you know, Carl Andre, people like that. And and Conrad was actually an artist before he was a dealer. He was in an exhibition that Paul Mance organized, in fact. Paul had ideas about being a curator. He worked in advertising. I met him when he came to New York, in fact. He worked for a big advertising firm. I forget the name of it now. It was a very big one. And he was living in New York for about 2 years. And he was talking about being a dealer, organizing shows, curating. He was always fascinated with this new art, something new, something different. And I'm not sure. He was living with a young artist, a guy, I can't think of, it was a very interesting, his name's escaping right now. And then after that, he was living with Gerd de Vries, who was a big scholar of John Cage. So, I mean, if you're studying John Cage, then immediately you're sort of into a whole sort of like thinking on the edge in terms of what constitutes art and, you know, where art was going.
We mentioned Lawrence Wiener and, you know, several artists in this particular exhibition and of that era were engaging text on the wall. So the other two pieces that we have here, one involves painting directly on the wall and the other one involves vinyl. What do you get out of the different media with those pieces? How do you see the sort of difference for the viewer between the vinyl-based works and the works where you're directly
Almost
painting?
Almost no. I don't really see that big a difference. Whatever works, sometimes I use them. Now I use, in the beginning I used to draw them myself, by hand. The piece here, the first time I ever showed that piece, was a pencil on a wall. Actually, the first time I typed it out on a piece of paper. Then the idea of putting it on a wall was just drawn by hand with pencil. Then I used a kind of a felt-tip pen when felt-tip pens were first came around, and then they had press type, where you could put each individual letter, and then they invented computers in a way of making. I did a show in Italy where I used a lot of words in Rome, and these guys, you know, show them the drawings, and these guys overnight cut out long sheets of paper with the letters cut out perfectly, and they would tape it on the all hand cut, and they would tape the paper on the wall and then just sort of use that as a kind of stencil to paint the words before they had computers that could cut it for them. But now with these thin vinyl films and the different colors, if I want a color that I just can't get in vinyl, or I want a certain kind of effect that you can't get in vinyl, then I have a stencil made and then I paint it myself.
Speaking about color, we can talk about the most recent work in the show, which is the 1983 untitled piece. So our staff painted a wall bright blue, and you've been here for the last 2 days, yeah. essentially making a drawing with oil stick of a tree on the blue wall.
Not necessarily a tree. Could be like the veins in your hand. It's a kind of a symbol or a metaphor for life, and you know, goes off the top, which is kind of, trees are interesting to me. I always use the tree image, and I was looking for an image to break from just words, quite frankly. And the tree image was an image that popped up in my photography and my film and so forth. And I decided to use it because it sort of stands up tall. It's kind of like us, you know, can relate to it in a certain way. It reaches up into the sky and it goes down into the earth. It's a kind of conduit of energy, sort of going around like this and coming out. And it represents a kind of a cyclical idea, which I spoke about earlier, and kind of a life force. And then I like the idea of sort of painting over it, like the skin over the veins in your hand, you know, where the life is going back and forth. And so you have this kind of motion, and then you have the words going around like this, sort of alternating, reflecting. I like the silver kind of reflects the light. The blue acts as a kind of absorption, and it covers the tree, but the silver kind of reflects the light in the room and sort of changes as the light in the room changes. So that's the idea of it.
What about the choice of the colors? The blue is beautiful.
Gotta choose a color, and blue is fine. You know, whatever wall paints, you go through the wall paints, and I like that blue.
Where do you see yourself, more specifically, in the history of painting?
It works against the red, too. I mean, the tree, I really like the idea of red, kind of, you know, like veins and stuff like that. And the blue kind of was like, just work well with it. I've used other colors and paintings and at different times, and you know, I did a series of paintings of old red paintings with trees. But just for this show, this piece comes out of a show I did at Leo Castelli. And I had four of those. I painted the whole gallery blue and did four of these big trees and words, and different variations. And some of the words were red and you know. So it was just, this piece at that time was blue. If another time it could have been red.
If we were to reinstall this work later on, which I'm sure we will, would we be allowed to do it in red?
You'd have to do it in red. Somebody else can do it. It's not a big deal drawing that tree. If you know what it looks like, it's no big deal.
I know you were
knock
downstairs.
It off in an hour or an hour and a half.
You were using a projection, right, of a slide. For
that was to just to, yeah, when Ponza bought the piece, he bought a kind of a, really a sort of a painting on paper, drawing painting on paper, as a kind of certificate, and then there's, on the reverse, there's a lot of instructions about how to make it, and with a suggestion if the artist is still available to have him supervise. But once you, but then it also says refer to photos of the piece originally. We photographed it and made the drawing. And Ponza should have a photo of the original installation someplace. Anyway, now you have a photo, and so it's makeable. It's being made now, and I'm not even there, you know? So I really came to just to sort of make sure it was done correctly and to do it and to see it again if I can before I go, because they were never remade after that show. I think Ponza bought the only one. No others were sold.
Painting is something you sort of worked with very early in your career and slightly went away from and then mm-hmm. strongly came back to in the 80s. What is it that, you know, what is it about painting that I, you know, really brought you back? Or
nothing special. Or I use what I have to, what I need. I'm making paintings now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, making, they're about 70-inch squares. And it's just what I, this is what I need to do now to do what I want to do. This is where my ideas are taking me. I hadn't made any large paintings for, I don't know when the last one was, maybe 10 years ago. I made a whole bunch of small ones. I did these, I bought like 100 little square canvases, you know, the kind that they sell to students or something, cheap little canvases. And I just started working out ideas on them. And they were cheap. If I didn't like it, I could just slash it and throw it away. I did a show of them. I did a couple of shows of them. And you could just sort of work out all kinds of ideas that way in terms of painting. And there isn't anything special about painting. I mean, I usually paint the wall or I do something. You know, I'm always working with paint in one way or another, whether it's on a wall or on a or stencil or, I don't know, you know, or on a canvas.
This piece and others involve, you know, text on top of paint. Does the spacing between the text, is that strictly a formal compositional decision? Or are you trying to convey something with almost like a syntax?
I'm trying to convey space between the words. So each word is isolated, or that it is an aesthetic decision in a sense that I do try and make some kind of balance or create some kind of visual interest in where the words are placed. Where they're placed is important. Sometimes it appears random. Sometimes they go off the edge. Sometimes you may only see a letter or two and you're really not quite sure what the word is. You know it's a word, but you're not really quite sure what it is. yeah, how they look, the size of them, the color. I try to keep it a very simple geometric format without a lot of embellishment or anything like that. Simple geometry.
We, for all intents and purposes, call you a conceptual artist as opposed to, say, a painter. How do you feel about that term? Do you feel
I'm neither one. What does conceptual art mean? I don't know. I have no definition for it. I've never met anybody that has. And I don't know any artists that call themselves conceptualists. Who's the most famous conceptual artist? You know, Lawrence Wiener? He hates the term. He never uses it. Kossuth, he uses it, but he used to use it. I don't know now. You had to have a very specific definition of what conceptual meant for him to be considered a conceptual artist. So the only use it has is that if somebody does a conceptual art show, they invite you to come and you can put your work in the show and get it shown. That's about the only value that it has. It's completely, has no meaning, really, and in some ways very misleading. I always, really, the most dematerialized work I've ever done still has some kind of material aspect to it. So, I've always worked with some kind of material. The material may not be tangible, it may not be visible, but it's there and it's in some way measurable. So, in some way, it's kind of misleading. I pushed it as far as I could with just simple text and using I did a series called Telepathic Works, which in fact I'm showing in New York next year, old works. And that's sort of pushing the idea of it about as far as you can. But this was a certain period back in the late 60s that I did this, and they're good works, they're perfectly fine. There's always some physical aspect to whatever I do. Painting, if I need to use paint, I use it. If I feel that's where I have what I need now, that's what I'll do. But I went for 20 years without making a painting in the traditional sense of a painting. So I can go for long periods without making a painting. But I may still use paint for something.
I think sometimes conceptual art is not just a term we use to describe the type of work, but the group of artists or the time period. And you and these other artists were really the first group of artists for whom that term was used readily. And I know you all were sort of cohorts and to some degree coming of age at the same time. Were you influencing each other's work?
We were talking to each other. How much influence, I don't really know. It'd be very hard to say. But there was a lot of talk. We'd hang out at Max's Kansas City, or, you know, everybody was talking to everybody else and visiting everybody else's studio. To me, it was a wonderful time. I had a ball back in the late 60s, and so nobody had any money, but it was really great to be in New York and then hang out and talk with these guys, and then go to Europe in the late 60s and 70s. But, you know, Buren came to New York, he was staying with Larry Weiner, Baldessari was in New York. I mean, invited me out to teach at CalArts, and I invited him to teach at Hunter. I was a teacher at Hunter at the time. It was good. I enjoyed my time. I liked it very much. And then we went to Europe and hung out with the Italians, the Art de Povera guys, and Mario Mertz, and everybody was very friendly with everybody, I think, and who knows who was. I'm sure everybody was sort of influencing everybody else, more or less.
How is your studio practice or experience of making art different now than it was during
more that isolated time? I don't really talk to anybody so much. A lot of my friends are dead. I go in my studio and work by myself, have a show. I still have friends, and they come to the shows. I don't go out anymore. There's not that kind of hanging out together aspect to it. Everybody's sort of separated and off in different countries. Making art is a very hard, solitary business, and never really quite sure what you're doing. Never really quite sure what you're doing is interesting or worthwhile, or that anybody else is going to care. And being a successful artist, I consider myself a successful artist because, not because I make a lot of money, but because so far there's always someone who's willing to give you an opportunity to do something, to show your work, to do a show. I'm at a stage where my studio, first of all, is closed. No one goes in there. No collectors, no dealers, nobody goes. If somebody wants to do a show, they just come to me and they say, I would like to do a show with you. Fine. And that's it. And they just have to trust me that whatever I show will work. It always does. I never have any complaints. But they don't come to my studio and look at work and say, well, I like this, I don't like that, I'm going to choose this. It doesn't work that way.
Interesting.